we've got a great we've got a great number of friends in here. We've got the team in here. I'm excited for tonight. Are you ready?
I'm ready. How many steps did you take today? You said you walked and got your steps in.
You know what? Actually, hold on. I'm gonna do this for everybody. Oh God, this can't be completely updated, but I have not gotten a ton in.
2,000? Congratulations, Ben. You're in heart attack territory.
It's freezing outside.
It is a bad day. I actually went to the mall today and walked.
Did you?
It's too cold out there. But yeah, you're talking about the guys at TriStar. You should take advantage of that.
It's a free movement screen.
They taught me how to do a proper deadlift.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, I went out and bought a trap bar, deadlift bar, hexagon, because of those guys. And I really like doing deadlifts. It's the only weight I lift that's fairly heavy. But you have to do good form, which they taught me. And, you know, it's probably the most important weightlifting exercise there is, the deadlift.
It is super interesting. First of all, those guys are incredible. If you're available that day, take advantage of these free movement screenings. If it fills out, hopefully we can get them back in later months. Dang, Katie, you got 12,000 steps.
Wow.
Dang, that's incredible. Margot, I don't know why I didn't get my walking in today. It's
2,000 steps. Congratulations.
2,000 is not enough. And this show is actually, this is good for me. I'm putting it up in front of everybody. I'm feeling a little bit like, man, I gotta be a little bit better, especially after all the benefits that you went over in today's podcast. You know, come on. I mean, today would be the day that I need to get like 12,000, 15,000 steps. You know?
Yeah, I know.
But anyways, my brother Steve's in the building. Brother Steve.
Hey, Steve.
What's going on? Great to see you. Deb's in the building. Deborah, what's going on? Let's see. Anna, welcome. Welcome in. So good to have everybody here. Welcome to the Performance Medicine Show. If you have a question for Dr. Rogers, go ahead and put those in the comments. We are going to go over a few questions that came in through email, Instagram, Facebook, all the different social channels throughout the week. So Doc, these are all really, really thoughtful questions. So thank you guys. We're gonna get the gears turning this afternoon, this evening. Okay, first one is about the stevia sweetener kind of controversy. I don't know how much context you need. The question is, I was wondering if you could discuss with your doc the info recently being reported about the stevia sweetener. And then it goes on to say it's being reported that regular use of stevia could be related to heart issues. But as I'm listening to more, I'm wondering if the problem may actually be more with erythritol that's often added to stevia in items.
It is in the news lately, last week or two, and I've looked at it. I actually looked at the study, and then I always look up Dr. Peter Attia and to see what he says about some of the stuff, because he's a brainiac genius with longevity, and he's really into that stuff. And he took a pretty deep dive on that study, too, and he kind of debunked it. It's really more about erythritol than it is stevia. And, you know, which is erythritol is a sugar alcohol. And a lot of times they combine them, you know, but so if you look at the study, it really wasn't a controlled study at all. Not that you have to have a double blind study, but it left a lot to, you know, it just made a lot of assumptions that just are not there. I don't think Dr. Attia sure didn't think so. If you want to get into about a 2-hour breakdown of it, go to Dr. Attia's last podcast on that subject a couple weeks ago. I actually did listen to it. And I'm not going to get into the nuances of it because it'd take me 2 hours. But the bottom line is you really produce more erythritol on your own than you do getting it from a supplement. So that's what they didn't account for, whether when they measured those levels, they didn't account for, they didn't know whether you produced on your own or, you know, you took it in. So, but it did show that people that had higher blood levels of erythritol were more likely to have heart disease. But he kind of debunked the study, so I wouldn't put much stock in it, really. You know, it's one of those sugar alcohols that won't raise your blood sugar. That actually has some protective effects, like it protects against cavities. Imagine that, a sugar that protects against cavities. But so, you know, it's out of all the sugar alcohols, it's the one that is least likely to cause diarrhea. But it still could if you ate too much of it. So I'm not against a little bit. It's like anything else, you know, consuming just a little bit is not going to hurt you, in my opinion. Stevia, we've always talked about that. Raw stevia is being a little cleaner than some of the others. If you get the organic type, again, a lot of these items are adulterated and, you know, they're really processed and all. They're not as good as they claim. So, you know, I would guess I like allulose. That's one of my favorite sweeteners. That's one that I know Atiyah talks a lot about. Monk fruit is probably next, and maybe blackstrap molasses. And of course, I like local raw, unfiltered honey. I love that. I eat a little bit of that every day. So don't freak out about that, thinking if you take a little bit of erythritol, you're going to have heart disease. I just don't think it's true. I think it's pretty much debunked. But look, go back and look at the study for yourself. And, you know, go to Dr. Atiyah's discussion on it. So a lot of times, you never know why the media comes up with some of this stuff. You know, I guess it just makes news, I guess. But, you know, again, you can overdo anything, including stevia and erythritol, any of them. So I wouldn't actually worry about it too much, to be honest with you. But those other ones are my favorites.
If you guys want to dive a little bit deeper into kind of what we think the best sweeteners are, Lucas Schmidt, our nutrition coach, did a Dive Into Diet episode on healthy sweeteners. Talks a lot about allulose, why it's the best, and some others as well. I think he actually gets into erythritol in depth. So you can check that out. You can see that on our YouTube channel. Let's get to, this was a really interesting one. I have seen online that different body types should alter their diet to their body type for better weight loss results. Is this true or is this a gimmick? And it goes on to say, according to an online test, my body type would be more estrogen dominant, which could block fat burning. It's stating I should eat more cruciferous vegetables to balance out the estrogen in my body to promote fat burning. I would like Dr. Rogers' thoughts on this. Super interesting. Because I can totally see how, you know, we're all unique. We all have different body types. And you say a lot, you know, the whole life isn't fair thing. You know, you might not be able to eat what your skinny friend could eat. What's your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I've seen those same, you know, advertisements, basically what they are. So I don't put much stock in it either. You know, you need to look at a lot of different things. It's true that people have different body shapes, android, gynoid. I mean, you know, apple versus pear shaped. But I think you have to look at a lot more than that. Of course, you have to look at your hormones as well. I mean, people that have more of a gyno body shape, more weight around your hips, sometimes are estrogen dominant, but that's all a matter of balancing your diet. Now, so you got to be careful with the foods, you know, so you may not want to eat soy in that case, but they categorize this thing so much and they're trying to sell you something usually. So I don't take a lot of stock in it. For example, cruciferous vegetables, you know, if you have Hashimoto's or hypothyroidism, you probably don't want to eat too many cruciferous vegetables. So you got to take all that into account. Look at all your hormone levels, like your insulin resistance numbers, all your, you know, estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, DHEA, cortisol, thyroid, vitamin D is actually a hormone. So you got to look at all that stuff. So I wouldn't go too much on that hype. Just kind of like the blood type diets, you know, some people swear by them. I think the bottom line is any kind of diet actually works. But they all fail too, unless you get to the root of the problem. And like I say, most people, you know, need some kind of help with this because it's really hard to figure. It's so complex that you can't just simplify it like they're trying to do on this body type thing. So there may be a little something to it as far as, you know, the shape of your body, whether you're estrogen dominant or not, but you need to actually check the labs and see where you're at on all those things. That's why I love the Cleveland panel. It tells me all that.
Such a great question.
Great question. I've seen a lot of those ads.
Yeah. I really love it when people are asking like questions that you see in the news, you see, you know, on Twitter or any of the social accounts. Super fun to talk about. So thank you for sending that in. This is a fun one right here. Is it possible to have both Graves and Hashimoto's? And there was, we sent you some information around both for some background here. Can you explain what Graves is? We've talked a lot about Hashimoto's, and I believe you're going to talk about hyperthyroidism soon. On a common
sense. Yeah, Graves is hyperthyroidism.
So Graves is hyper.
Yeah, and okay. Hashimoto's is lower thyroid function, and they're both autoimmune. The antibodies are different kinds of antibodies. I think Graves may be an antibody to TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone. And with Hashimoto's, which is much more common, very common, you have two kinds of antibodies to TPO and antithyroglobulin antibodies. So they're different, but you could certainly, you know, have both, usually not at the same time, but they can kind of switch back and forth between the two. So a lot of people that have Graves will end up with Hashimoto's. You know, they go from hyper to hypo, and a lot of it depends on what you've actually, how you treated the Graves disease. But, you know, I'll get into that a little bit more when I end up doing the podcast on hyperthyroidism, which is Graves. But they're both autoimmune diseases. And, you know, you can certainly vacillate between the two, more commonly from Graves to Hashimoto's. But really interesting. You know, once you have one autoimmune disease, you're more likely to have another one, whether it be diabetes or, you know, a thyroid autoimmune disease or, you know, any of the other number of autoimmune diseases like RA, lupus, MS, all those. But that's a good point there. That's a good question. You could have both, usually not at the same time. One's overactive, one's underactive. One stimulates the thyroid too much. One inhibits the thyroid.
So I'm sure that would like, you'd have to switch between treatments or the way you go about treating.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, based on lab results?
Yeah. Symptoms and lab results.
Interesting.
Yeah. I know what you're doing with this, but.
Yeah. I'm pumped about that episode. That's going to be fun. If you guys want to hear more about Hashimoto's, look up Hashimoto's, within the YouTube channel. We've done a Common Sense MD episode on it. Semaglutide question, getting a ton of semaglutide questions come in throughout the week. Can semaglutide in pill or tablet form still be as effective as the injection? 3 milligrams, pros and cons. What's your thoughts on this?
Well, in my experience, the injections work better. In my experience, sometimes if the insurance won't cover the injections, they may cover, the pill form. But the thing about the pill form, you take it every day and you have to take it on an empty stomach with no more than 4 ounces of water because it'll wash off your stomach. It actually kind of works by hanging onto your stomach. So I do prefer the once a week shot. It seems to be more effective for both weight loss and diabetic control. And you, 3 milligrams is a starting dose. And what's weird about it, you can't take 2-3 milligrams to double it, because you'll take one, it'll, and if you take another one, when you drink that 4 ounces of water, it washes the first pill off, so you can't do it. So you have to actually go from the 3 to 7 to the, I think, 14. But good question. I prefer the injection form.
So you have to like calculate how much it's going to wash out. That's why you take the 7 the second time?
No, because the 7's in one pill.
Oh.
If you take 2 pills, you're going to wash the first one off.
Got it.
Yeah.
Super interesting. I didn't know that it came in pill form. It's a great question there. Thank you for came in on Instagram. Thank y'all for
good question.
Following us over there. I'm looking for my next question. This is I do believe this is the last one that came in throughout the week. So this is a doozy. I'm really, really pumped about this. If you guys have a question for Doc, we're getting ready to go live into the live comments here, answer some health and wellness questions. This was a doozy. If you were on a deserted island and could choose one single food that you think would most help you survive, what single food would you choose and why? The context is that this came up in a Q&A session with Dr. Mark Hyman, who we're both big fans of. I have no idea what he said, and I have no idea what you're going to say. So
let me think about this for a second.
Well, I do know what Katie would say.
Katie would probably say beef liver, but here's why I wouldn't say that. And I'm going to do a podcast on beef liver next week. Cause I actually ate some raw beef liver today. Washed it straight down, Ben.
Red meat. Did you really?
Yeah, I did. And Katie said the reason you couldn't survive on beef liver only is because it doesn't have enough calories in it. You need some calories. So I guess if I was on an island, I would choose fish, because number one, you're on an island. You can fish, and all the fish you can spear, whatever you're going to do. And fish certainly has a lot of the good fats. It has protein, doesn't have carbs. You don't need carbs to survive. So I wouldn't eat plants, because plant protein is not real bioavailable. I don't know of any one plant that I could exist on. So unless it was a coconut, which does have good fats and omega-3s in it and calories, but I'd probably choose fish. I think you could sustain yourself on fish. You certainly don't need carbs, and you get all the omegas you want in fish. So I'd do that. And if I could have a supplement, it'd be beef liver. So I would have them, I would eat fish, and I'd have them send some beef liver over.
Okay.
Or maybe I would just eat the fish liver. You know, that's what cod liver is. It's actually liver from a cod fish. And that's what they used cod liver oil years ago, and still use it for a great remedy for a lot of things. You know, sometimes the old-fashioned remedies actually work better than the new stuff. So I would choose fish, I think.
I'd have to say, like, it's a pretty nice deserted island if you can get beef liver, you know, hand delivered to you for your for your sustenance.
That'd be really good.
Okay, so fish plus beef liver, I like it. Mark said something interesting: something with vitamin C, or you'll die from scurvy. That's interesting.
Yeah. You know. Well, you may have to scrounge you up some fruit. You know, maybe you could do that. But if it's only one,
go with fish. Real quick, and I don't know if anyone in here cares, but I do. What would be your desert island book?
Oh, to read on a desert island?
Yeah, if you can only have one book on a desert island, what would it be? Deserted island.
Man. That's a toughie there. Probably Castaway. That way I could learn how to get off the island. Remember that Tom Hanks movie? I guess it was a book. I don't know.
That's like the idea of like, if you could have three wishes, you know, one wish has to be for, you know, endless wishes or something, or a genie bottle. I just got to put this up here because Al Amin here is from Bangladesh, and I want to welcome
him. Oh, that's amazing.
It seems it's in the morning where he's at. I'm just so glad you're here, man.
Me too. We've never had anybody from that far away.
That's incredible. That is incredible. Thank you for hanging out with us, Al Amin. We're over in Tennessee. It's around a little after 7 p.m. our time. So good morning to you, my friend. Thank you for hanging out with us tonight. Awesome. All right, let's get to the questions. I'll put this up. Barbara would say cake. Little cake.
Go out in style.
I like it. I like it. All right, let's get to the live questions, guys. If y'all have questions for Doc, go ahead and put them in. If I missed your email, your question through email, I will go back and try and find it, and that'll be first up next week. I hope I didn't miss anybody. I didn't ask this question. Sorry. I have no idea how I missed this one. Can you cover CJC 1295 and BPC 157 peptide? Did I ask this?
No.
Okay, good. This is a peptide question, guys. Talk to us a little bit about these two.
Yeah. Well, those are two totally different peptides. CJC 1295 is really a growth hormone releasing hormone. It's usually combined. I've never used it alone. I usually use it with ipamorlin, which is another type of growth hormone stimulating secretagogue. So when you use CJC 1295 and ipamorlin together, which is usually the way you do that, you're hitting two sides of the pituitary to help release more of your own growth hormone. That's why they call it secretagogue. Instead of taking growth hormone, you can stimulate your own production. That's the whole idea behind a peptide. There's a lot of them, which is a string of amino acids that act as a signaler to turn another organ on that'll produce something. So the CJC 1295 is one that's designed to stimulate your pituitary to produce more growth hormone. And the ipamorlin in that really, it turns on the production of ghrelin. That's, you know, people think of it as the a gut hormone that regulates appetite. But they seem to work really well. Most people take somorlin. It's, you know, it's just more commonly used because it's a lot less expensive than the CJC 1295 with ipamorlin. So I think if you have enough money, I'd take that probably first, and then a good second choice and probably more affordable and maybe more easy to get is somorlin. Some people call it cimarillin. I call it somorlin. But in any event, they're both really good to produce more growth hormone, which is more of a repair hormone. So it works very well with in combination with testosterone and all the, as well as the female hormones. So for people that work out a lot, it tends to maybe lean you up a little bit, promotes muscle growth, promotes healing, and it's a really good peptide. BPC 157 is a little different. It's another peptide. It's really a gut peptide, to be honest with you. That's where it's produced. But when you augment with it, it's called body protection complex. It's really good. It's really the only peptide that I'll use orally. It's really good for gut dysfunction, but it's really good for repair as well, general body repair. Some people inject it into areas of tendonitis and It works pretty well. You got to inject it daily for a while though. Most of the time I prescribe that. I prescribed a guy that today, injection form. He's trying to recover from an accident. And I put a lot of people on that for gut dysfunction orally. If you're doing it for repair, like from an accident, you'd use the injection form. It's just more potent. But there are two different reasons you use them. They're both pretty commonly used and very effective. Both great for better aging, for bone strength, for brain health, muscle growth, and repair. So I hope that helps. Two different things.
I'll put this up from...
in other words, BPC-157 will not increase your growth hormone, though. And go to Robin's. Robin does some amazing videos on... her video.
We did one explain this episode on BPC-157, and then we did another episode of explain this on Somorlin. Both go real deep. Robin goes detailed on, you know, how to use them, what they're for, who they're helpful for. So definitely check those out. If you search for Somorlin and Robin Riddle, it'll come up, as well as BPC Robin Riddle. It'll show up.
Her explanation of the MTHFR gene is a really, really good
one. Yeah.
I recommend everybody watch that. And why does it matter?
Yeah.
It does. We check everybody's. And then I'm looking forward to seeing her APOE discussion. I haven't seen that one yet.
Okay. Yeah. I'm with you. Robin's saying we'll do one on CJC and Ipamorlin.
Okay.
So expect those from Explain This shortly. Again, explain this. We did one on APOE today, and last week was on what you're saying, Doc, MTHFR. If you guys want to dive into those two gene mutations, well worth the time, especially if you've gone through a Cleveland Heart consult or have done the Cleveland Heart panel. Okay, let's see here. I'm going to put this up from Holly just because it's kind of goes right along with what we're talking about here. How long after starting Somorlin will you see results in muscle growth?
It'll take a couple months. And again, you probably, depending on what your other hormones look like, especially testosterone, male or female, it's just a good combination. And remember, you know, you can take any of those, and unless you're exercising, you're not going to see any muscle growth. So meaning usually some resistance exercises, but it takes a while. You're not going to notice anything for a while. You know, if you're not feeling anything in a month, keep going. Mm. 2, maybe 3 months. So give it a good shot for sure. Cause it's not going to be overnight. Not like something like testosterone or something like that. Our real growth hormone, which I don't promote because number one, it's illegal for me to prescribe unless you have pan hypopituitarism. And then it'd be so expensive. It's unbelievable. And then there's side effects from it too. And you just don't see that with Somorlin. It's non-controversial. It's affordable, but be patient. It's going to take a little bit.
All right, Holly, hope that helps, guys. As you can see, we're getting into the comments here, answering your questions live for you. Let's get to Elena here. This is something you'll see in all of our offices, Circ O2. Would Circ O2 make your legs hurt?
I haven't seen that with Circ O2. You know, it helps your body release nitric oxide, so it's a vasodilator. This makes me wonder if you have some venous insufficiency, leaky valves in your lower extremities that may be opened up by this. So if you have some, you know, if you have spider veins and or worse, then maybe it could. I just haven't had anybody complain about that. So if that happens, what you need to do is go over to the, you know, vein company and get your lower extremity circulation checked out. That's the only reason I could fathom that it would cause that. But I guess it's possible.
All right. Thank you, Elena, for that question. Let's see if
I... And always, if you think something causes it and it's not really a severe reaction, stop it, see what happens with your symptoms. Then a couple of weeks later, try it again. If it happens again, it's you can pretty sure that's what it is.
All right. We still there?
Yeah.
Okay. My audio went out there for a second. Okay, guys, let's get to, I'm looking for questions here. I hope I'm not missing anybody. Let's get to Anthony. Ace Performance Picks guy. Thank you for being here, Anthony. Once you've had the calcium heart scan, is it necessary to have another one periodically to make sure you're taking enough vitamin K to prevent calcium from being deposited from taking vitamin D? I am over 50. I can't take a large amount of vitamin K due to hematocrit creeping up.
Yeah, you don't need to take a large amount of vitamin K anyway. You know, maybe I think it's 180 milligrams of MK7. I think it's the best one. But yeah, I mean, you want to follow it, but and they say, well, you don't need it, but once every 10 years. Sometimes I'll send people back after 5 years, but you just don't need to. It's not going to change that quickly. Like I had somebody that wanted to get it done in 6 months after their first one, and they started taking some EDTA, and it's just too early. It takes years for that to go. So I wouldn't do it any closer than 5 years. And if you're not worried, every 10 years, probably. A lot of the calcium scoring, you know, it depends on your age and what your score is and what your risk factors are, you know. So I try to get a baseline men at 40, women at 50. Mm. And then every 10 years, if there's no risk factors and everything's looking great, if I'm worried, you know, sometimes I'll do it sooner, but you're probably not going to see a major reversal, you know, on that calcium scoring anytime quickly. That's a great question. Great question.
All right, Anthony, thank you for that question there. If you have a question for Dr. Rogers, go ahead and put it in the comments. We're going to get to every single question tonight. This is from Mark. Question is, what are your thoughts on the Fed's move to rein in the prior authorization system? Should it be completely done away with in physicians' offices? This is a really interesting question that I didn't know happened. The prior authorization system is, we call it is a PA, where you need to get some sort of approval from, yeah, from an insurance company.
Yeah. You know, even not being a cash clinic like I am, we have to deal with PAs every day. You can talk to the nurses. They hate it. Yeah, I do. I don't like them. I think it should be done away with, you know. Really, it's just a way to keep denying coverage for medications. Now, granted, because of abuse of the system, you know, doctors brought it on themselves, probably. But so, you know, I guess you've got to rein the cost of some of these medicines in a little bit. But my thing is they should make it more affordable in the first place so you don't have to worry about it. And if you have a doctor, PA, nurse practitioner that is responsibly prescribing medications, that should be what the authorization. Your patients need it, you know, and usually it really just, it's a lot more hassle on everybody. Probably that increases the cost of medicine in itself. Mm, yeah. So yeah, I don't like them, hate them. I hate them. I'm not sure I have a better answer for some of these things with the cost of some of these things. I mean, because of some prescribers will overdo it, you know? So it's a toughie. It's a real toughie. There's not a lot of trust right now in medicine. And certainly Insurance companies don't trust doctors. Doctors don't trust insurance companies. So it's all a question of money. And it's just sad that it has to happen. Even, you know, ordering an MRI, a lot of times I'll have to get on the phone and talk to somebody who knows nothing about medicine on whether or not I can order an MRI on that patient. So, you know, things are kind of moving more towards a cash-based thing anyway, both for, you know, routine health care and prescription medications. You know, with programs like GoodRx, where you can get stuff really inexpensively. I told you the story about the modafinil I prescribed. A guy went to CVS, $850 a month. We looked on GoodRx at Food City. It was $35 a month for generic modafinil. So, you know, you have to wade your way through these healthcare waters. And unless it's, in my opinion, unless it's something ridiculous, like you need to get on Humira or a biologic or one of those, you know, maybe a cancer drug or experimental drug, maybe it should have some prior authorization. But for routine stuff that we're using medications to help the patient, I don't like it.
You know, I haven't thought about it from the standpoint of like there's distrust on both sides. Insurance companies aren't trusting the medical practice, and the medical practice doesn't trust the insurance companies. So it's like there's maybe a necessary kind of push pull, you know?
A lot of it, I think, is because of the system, the way we have it now, because of insurance. Because they can, number one, they control things, but people expect them to pay for everything, and they just are not going to. They can't. I mean, you can't have a system where you pay, you know, your monthly insurance premium and think you have carte blanche to get any tests you want to a doctor to order. You know, you can't get an MRI on anybody that has a headache. I mean, you know, the system's already practically bankrupt. You know, if you let that go, then, you know, there would be no reining in of cost. So, you know, a lot of times what I'll do, if I have somebody that insist, you know, they come in and, you know, they have a headache or something, that I check them out and I don't think they need, you know, a brain scan for that. But if they insist on one, which sometimes they just want to be reassured, I guess, I'll approach it like this. Look, your insurance is not going to pay for this, so I'll be glad to order you a cash MRI on your head. And sometimes they, okay. Other times, well, no, let me see if my headache gets better. So, you know, a lot of times I'll put it in the hands of the patient. Hey, if you really want to get this, you can pay cash where there's a cash price. That's what you should do. So, you know, you really find out who's worried and who isn't worried. So
yeah, that's really interesting how that changes behavior. And we've always talked about that with, you know, with the cash only model, you know, most people are going to take a little more ownership. And like you said,
that's before, what happened. And that's exactly what happened, Ben. Many years ago when insurance came into play, which when I was practicing, I mean, when they first came in, they would pay anything. Anything a doctor ordered, it was covered. Anything a doctor charged, they paid you 100%. So a lot of doctors just abused it, you know, and so that's what happened. They reined it in, and now they're making the decisions rather than the doctor, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's wild. But I think, you know, we always talk about taking control of your own health, and it seems to me like the best way to approach it is just, you know, stay healthy and, you know, take care of yourself and, you know, look into things, kind of be your own doctor, the way we talk about a lot.
And your doctor or healthcare provider should know what they're doing. You know, if they go, and a lot of them, they order too many tests because they're scared of getting sued, you know, so they overdo it because, oh, what if that patient has a brain tumor? They came here with a headache. What if they have a brain tumor? You know, I better order an MRI just to cover my butt, even though I know it's not a brain tumor, you know, because because I've sat there and examined the patient and talked to the patient, you know, very unlikely. So, you know, it's a toughie though. That's what makes medicine an art as well as a science. You know, there's no, it's not cut and dried, you know, and so anyway, it's interesting. Good yeah, question.
That really, you know, I was actually talking to Steve about pharmacy benefit managers today and kind of what their role is. And I'm going to try and dive a little bit deeper because that's completely different than a PA, isn't it? Like a
The PBMs are they're there to suck the money out of the system. That's what they're there for. And they've been bought up by, like, CVS bought their own PBMs because they couldn't compete with them. And so it's like a monopoly, really.
What do they do?
They negotiate drug prices from wholesale drug companies for large groups, like your CVS's and Walgreens. And so their original intent was to get the best price for a large group volume discount. So they'd go in and say, we're going to pay you this. We've got this amount of people insured by Aetna. So this is what we're going to pay you for those medicines from CVS. And, you know, it'd be way lower than they wanted to charge for it. So CVS got smart. They bought Aetna. So they own the PBMs. So it's really like, it should be illegal, really. And really those PBMs, they make millions. You know, they're getting rich off something they shouldn't even be involved in my opinion. But that's just business. It's terrible.
It's super
greed,
interesting.
Greed.
I'm going to get to another question here from Mark because it's kind of along the same lines. And if we're going to be here another couple minutes, so if y'all have questions for Doc, go ahead and put them in. We're going to get to everybody tonight. You know, we'll try to be, you know, gentle with this answer, Doc. What's your thoughts on things we've learned over the last 3 years?
I tell you what I've learned, really, is to keep my mouth shut. I've been censored so many times because of what I think. And just come and talk to me about it. I'll tell you exactly what I think. All I can tell you is I was right. You know, and that's not bragging, but I just have common sense. And I will say everything they did in the last 3 years, they just screwed everything up. Anything they possibly could have done wrong, they did wrong. So that's what we've learned. You know,
what do you think has improved over in the last, I'll say one, and I think telemedicine, the kind of the spotlight that's been put on telemedicine, I think it's bringing more access to providers. You know, more and more people can get into, you know, to see performance medicine, for example. But everywhere else you can, you know, cross state lines now, you know,
that's a very good point, Ben.
That
came out of this, the cross being able to practice in different states because you're licensed and board certified or whatever, they should be able to do that. I mean, there's no reason not to. I think we've learned that you don't need to trust the government with your health care. That's for one thing. You need to look out for yourself, use your common sense, and don't get into this herd mentality. I mean, you know, herd mentality is a dangerous thing. It really is. And we saw it. You know, we saw people that drank the Kool-Aid and now they're sorry they drank the Kool-Aid. And so take care of yourself, preventive medicine. You know, if you're healthy, you're probably going to do fine in a pandemic. They're outliers. There surely were. I saw everything. You know, I saw it from every angle. I think I saw everything that could happen with that. And there were outliers, just like there's outliers everywhere. The guy here in Kingsport was walking his dog on the sidewalk. The guy ran over and killed him and his dog a few days ago. So you can't control everything, you know, but you can sure look after your own health, get lean, take your supplements, do your screening test. It's just really sad what happened. I hope we've learned some lessons, because this is not going to be the first pandemic we're going to see, you know. So I hope we've learned that lesson. Take care of your health, appreciate what you have, and use some common sense. That was what was missing with some of the decisions I made, was common sense. And again, I can't say too much, but if you want to talk to me, probably someday I will. Someday I'm not afraid of getting censored again. I like doing these shows. I like doing podcasts. I like for it to be on YouTube. And, you know, I like to help people out with what I think. And when I get to a point where I'm pretty comfortable with that, I'm going to really come out with it.
You know? Well, I do think, you know, I think more and more people realize, you know, the importance of, you know, keeping a strong immune system. So, you know, same thing with telemedicine becoming more and more of a real option. People having more access to great providers. Great question there, Mark. Thank you for kind of starting that conversation. I think it's one that, you know, we'll continue to have, and hopefully, you know, on these Tuesday nights, we keep talking about, you know, different things we can do to stay healthy, to prevent some of these preventable diseases.
And what things are worse? There's a lot of things that are worse have come out as a result of some of these policies. I mean, you could list them all day long. I mean, we see it in our office every day. You know, people are a lot more unhealthy, you know, for various reasons. But, you know, it's terrible. It's just everyday things that shouldn't be happening.
Super interesting. Super interesting. Thank you for talking with us about that. And man, I mean, the last 3 years for you as a doctor, I can imagine will stand out to you as you look back on your career. You know, it's been a wild couple of years to say the least. Okay, let's get to Candy here. Thank you for putting this in, Candy. Do you think it's possible to lower your calcium score with better diet like carnivore and low carb?
Yeah, I love carnivore. I love low carb, keto, even though keto is kind of hard to stay in. I do. Again, I wouldn't freak out too much about your calcium score unless it's really high. You know, everybody's, you know, we start to get atherosclerosis when we're kids. You know, we really do. And the calcium score, it's a good corollary, but it's not a perfect test. In other words, you can't really tell whether that calcium deposits on the inside or the outside of the arteries. So, you know, it's not, certainly if you have a really high calcium scoring, it deserves maybe a further workup, if you're asymptomatic, like a treadmill test, or certainly to think about your other risk factors. You know, I like, you know, when I watch my calcium score go from zero 10 years ago to 92 last year, I started, you know, thinking about that and started taking some EDTA, which hopefully will claw a little bit out. You know, but I certainly think you can change most things by the way you eat. I really do. The key to your health, besides moving every day, is what you put in your mouth. And we live in a toxic world. The main way we get toxins is through eating them. Just a lot of processed things in those foods. I talked to a cattle farmer today about, he's raising grass-fed cattle, and he talked about the, what do you call it, stockyard cattle that most beef comes from, and how how terrible, you know, the stuff that they're in and all the antibiotics they have to have, mostly for weight gain, and all the toxins in there that, you know, it really, you talk to him, you would never eat grain-fed beef from slaughterhouses. Maybe a little bit of grain from somebody that you know they're raising pastured, you know. He educated me a lot on using a little bit of it. You know, if you can get all grass-fed, grass-finished, it's probably better, but that's really, really hard to do. But yeah, I think you can, but don't freak out about just a moderate calcium scoring.
Thank you for that question there, Candy. Let's get this from Roel. Would you know where some carnivores or why some carnivores use maple syrup on organ meats? I hope
make
I'm
it taste
right.
better. Probably make yeah. it taste better. I know I downed my raw beef liver today with a cup of fresh orange juice, freshly squeezed orange juice. I didn't even taste the beef liver. But anyway, yeah, maple syrup is actually not a bad form of sugar. So just to make it tolerable, I guess. You know, a lot of people will soak their beef liver in milk before they sear it. And that makes it the taste better. Huh. They'll do that for soak it for half hour to an hour in milk. And that seems to be pretty effective. I assume it's to make it taste a little better.
Katie's saying for the taste as well as the benefits like you get from honey, good way to get carbs, sugars. Interesting. Yeah. Thank you for putting that in there, Katie. Great question there. Great question. Mm-hmm. Well, guys, it looks like we are, let's see. Okay, Katie's saying Carnivore MD puts maple syrup in his milk. Interesting. That's mm-hmm. really interesting. I need to look more into Carnivore MD. I know he's kind of a...
Dr. Salandino.
Yeah, he's the...
He's got some good stuff. Read the Carnivore Code. Especially if you're having gut problems, you might consider it, you know. Really interesting. And carnivore with beef liver. Not a bad way to go on a desert island.
Jasmine, are you gonna try some beef liver? I think everyone on this show is gonna end up taking beef liver daily.
If you see my podcast, well, I'll put a podcast out next week about it. You'll probably definitely be doing it after that. And some people just get supplements, you know, desiccated instead of eating. Cooking it or eating it raw.
Real quick, before Ike and Izzy steal the show.
There's Ike right here.
But before they steal the show, I'm just going to put this up here. Carter noted, she said something about my hair. I've been waiting all evening. I think Katie might have said something too. I just want to say thank you. Thank you guys for, you know, recognizing I got a haircut.
How much did that haircut cost? Do you want to say that on air? I'd be afraid to.
My grandmother is recognizing I'm having a great hair day. I'm not wearing a hat. Jasmine says I look great. There we go. Okay.
Here's Izzy. She's getting big, isn't she?
Look at Izzy. Izzy, how you doing? So if you're new to the show, this is Izzy, the newest addition to the family. She is either... sister or girlfriend to Ike. I don't know.
They're not related.
Okay. Hi, Izzy. You're a cutie.
Well, they are best friends. They're best friends.
She's been with us for the last couple weeks.
Come here.
Looking forward to seeing
you. Now, listen,
brother.
I got an announcement to make. Ike? Ike turns 1 year old in two days.
Hi, Ike. When?
In 2 days. He turns 1 year old.
He's one?
Yeah.
Look at Ike.
He wants to kiss me. I don't like to kiss a dog on the mouth.
Hi,
I'd rather eat beef liver than kiss a dog on the mouth.
Ike, say hello to all your fans. Say hello. Guys, we appreciate y'all hanging out with us each Tuesday. We do this every single week, 7 p.m. We answer your health and wellness questions. Pop Man, thank you so much.
I love your haircut.
Thanks, guys, for listening to this episode of the podcast. Please share the podcast with your friends. And if you haven't subscribed yet, please subscribe. We will see you guys next time.